This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Taylor Quimby, in for Virginia Prescott. When it comes to music, Americans have a bit of a love affair with the offbeat, the musical misfits, those out-of-tune vocalists that manage to captivate audiences despite having less than perfect technique or tone. But it's more complicated than that, because sometimes we love to love bad singing, sometimes we love to hate it, and sometimes bad singing transcends its badness and somehow becomes good. Carl Wilson is music critic for Slate, where he recently wrote about this very subject. It's a sort of meditation on our cultural attraction and repulsion to bad singing. And he joins us now to talk about it with me. Carl, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Hi, Taylor. Thanks for having me.
Of course. So obviously, there's a lot of different ideas about what bad singing is and maybe how we react to it as a society. And off the bat, one of my first thoughts is that it's clear that this has a lot to do with context, right?
Absolutely. You know, music in general is always contextual, and there's different traditions and different genres, and what's considered good and bad in each is really kind of fixed by its history and by its audience. And so whenever we talk about bad singing, there's really no sort of objective thing that you can point to as bad singing in all kinds of circumstances. All kinds of styles and all kinds of things can work in the right place. You know, it's the same way that you might, on the one hand, have a rough kind of rustic singer like Hank Williams, and you can't easily put that up alongside an operatic diva and talk about good singing and bad singing as though that's the same thing in each of those contexts.
Right. Although I will say, of all the different clips that you put in your article, there are some that are closer to being what we might call objectively bad, even if that doesn't exist. I want to play a clip. This is Ice JJ Fish. His song On the Floor has over 50 million views on YouTube, so still popular. Let's listen to a little bit.
It's something about the girl that just makes my head wanna twirl. Oh, you got me want to tell all them other girls. There's nothing else better on this world. The moment I seen her, I was in shock. So shocked.
Oh, man. When that harmony comes in, that's tough.
Yeah, that's kind of the special moment. Yeah, it's interesting. You know, that guy's real name is Daniel McLeod. He's from San Antonio, Texas, and he just started posting songs on YouTube the way that people do nowadays. And YouTube has really become kind of this amazing forum for all kinds of music making, including this kind of modern version of the tradition of bad singing. And I think one of the things that fascinates people about somebody like him is this question of, like, what he perceives himself to be doing. Like, does he think that he's just singing great R&B there?
Right.
Or does he understand there's something comical about it? And if you look at internet forums, people argue about whether it's an act, whether he's joking, and all of these things at great length and have been for years now. And that's something you see throughout the history of these kind of novelty bad singing acts.
Yeah, I was thinking that same thing. Awareness of, you know, your voice seems to be such a big part of it, because if you're unaware, then there's something maybe charming about the authenticity. But if you know it's a joke, then if you're playing it really well, it's almost impressive how well you're faking us all.
Yeah, I think that's right. And I think it's also just, it's hard to tear yourself away from that uncertainty, that feeling of not knowing what you're seeing, not knowing what you're hearing. And that's kind of mesmerizing in itself.
Yeah, you bring up this kind of concerning point, though, and I hadn't thought too much about it, but you know, somebody like Ice JJ Fish or singing sensations like William Hung from American Idol. He famously did a really, you know, pretty painful rendition of She Bangs in front of the judges at the beginning of the show. You know, it seems like a lot of these people, they're from other cultures, they're people of color, and there's this feeling that maybe this is not in good spirits.
Yeah, I mean, that's, you know, on the one hand, there's that feeling of authenticity and sincerity that you think maybe there's an appreciation of some kind of universal humanity that goes on when we laugh or and enjoy this kind of performance. And then on the other side, there's kind of a frightening kind of freak show element to it. And it's really true that, you know, going back to the days of P.T. Barnum, there have been these kinds of freak act things in the history of American culture. And that's something that we have to be self-conscious about. And, it, you know, it's not a coincidence that a lot of these things that become sensations on YouTube or through American Idol are people who are racialized and who are not, you know, white straight men, just sort of standing out as representations of the dominant culture And that's something that I think we need to be self-conscious about.
Well, I want to play another clip of something that we might call bad singing and talk about how, again, context plays a big role in how we look at this piece of music. This is Yoko Ono, and she's performing, I think, at a gallery, and it is a cover of a Katy Perry song. You may or may not be able to tell what it is. Okay, so if you couldn't tell, that was a cover of, I think, Firework.
Is that sounds like song? It was Fireworks.
Yeah, Fireworks by Katy Perry, the being performed by Yoko Ono. But this is such a good example because you might hear that and be like, oh, what terrible singing. But of course, she's not trying to be a good singer in this moment. This makes much more sense if you put it into the context of something like performance art, in which there's a different set of rules, right?
Yeah, I mean, that's the interesting thing about the reputation of Yoko Ono, you know, because she actually came out of this very sort of high art tradition, and at a time in the 60s when she was affiliated with people like John Cage and his circle, where there was a lot of musical experimentation going on, and this sort of, this group called Fluxus that she was involved with did a lot of just sort of trying to take the materials of everyday life and make them strange, and her performance style was kind of evolved in that way, and with influences as well from traditional Asian music, and there's sort of a feminist statement in it and all of that. And then she hooks up with John Lennon, and suddenly new audiences are looking at her in the context of the Beatles, which, you know, really has nothing to do with the kind of thing that she did. And if people are listening to her sing and want it to sound like Love Me Do, then it sounds like pretty terrible singing. But that's really not what's going on at all. She's really an important pioneer of sort of vocal experimentation, especially for women in the history of new music.
I'm speaking to Carl Wilson, Slate's music critic, and we're talking about bad singing, why so many of us love it or love to hate it or just feel something about it, and we're not sure exactly what that is. One of the reasons that you wrote this article, I think, is because Florence Foster Jenkins, a singer, is getting her moment in the spotlight again with a new biopic starring Hugh Grant and Meryl Streep playing Jenkins. Can you give us a quick background on how does her story relate to this subject?
Yeah, well, Florence Foster Jenkins is kind of a classic case of, you know, these things we've been talking about, the sort of mystery of the bad singer and their intentions. She was a New York socialite in the first half of the 20th century, and a really important contributor financially and socially to supporting music in New York in that time. And she would sort of hold events to raise money for the opera and for the symphony and all that kind of thing, that kind of normal charitable work. But she, throughout her life, always had ambitions to be a musician herself. And she gave these recitals regularly where she would sing for her social peers. And she sang opera repertoire that was way beyond her ability. And so she gave these recitals and was constantly singing flat and singing off and losing control of her voice. And it became kind of a cult thing in New York society. People would come and kind of pretend that she was singing well in order to humor her, but also to sort of enjoy the experience vicariously. And then in her old age, she was not well for various reasons. And her delusions kind of got grander and grander, and she eventually rented out Carnegie Hall and held a public recital to which all of New York could come, sold out the place, still one of the most sort of storied Carnegie Hall concerts ever. And that was when the game was kind of up and the mockery of her went public, and it was kind of a heartbreaking end to her life. And it's really unclear whether she was just overambitious and just singing beyond her range, or whether she had some kind of perceptual disorder. She had been a prodigy pianist when she was a young girl, and so it's not that she wasn't musically talented, and people don't know whether it was her illness, she contracted syphilis from her first husband, whether it was some kind of nerve degeneration, or whether it was just these delusions of grandeur. It became kind of a legendary story in music history.
Yeah. Well, let's hear a little example. I mean, we can't talk about her without hearing her voice. So this is Florence Foster Jenkins.
When judging those
Yeah, so there we go. It is funny. It makes me think of how the venue and the place, it has so much to do with how we perceive these things. Because, you know, if you've got a friend who has a decent voice, you might be like, oh, my friend's got a great voice. But if you put them on a big stage and you expect them to stand side by side with performers that are of incredible technical skill, you know, you might be aghast at that same person who you previously praised.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. One of the things about singing is, you know, that we all can do it, or most of us do it, but nobody really knows how they sound, right? Because your voice resonates differently inside your body and inside your head than it does out in the world. And so, you know, all of the great singing that we think we do in the shower probably sounds kind of more like Florence Foster Jenkins when you've if you had to get up on stage in Carnegie Hall. And that's, I think, one of the things that makes her story kind of human on that level. And again, there's that double-sidedness, because on the other hand, here's this rich lady whose friends all kind of conspired to sustain this delusion that she had, partly because it kept her enthusiastic about doing her charitable work and giving money to the real musicians of New York. And so, you know, and on one hand, it's this sort of touching sincerity, and on the other hand, it's this kind of disturbing illusion. And it's hard to know where to stand there. Sure.
Well, I was thinking, again, we talked about authenticity, but there's that one piece that you brought up at the end of your article. It's from a movie I haven't seen called Young at Heart, but it's such a perfect example of somebody who is not what we would call technically gifted, but whose voice resonates with such an emotional realness that it seems so much more powerful than somebody who's got, you know, the pipes, the runs, all that stuff. Let's listen to it a little bit. This is an older gentleman. He's on stage. He's actually covering a song by Coldplay. And this is from the documentary Young at Heart.
Lights will guide you home, and in night your bones, and I will try fix you.
I mean, this video is pretty amazing to watch. Can you describe a little bit what we're seeing or what we're listening to?
Yeah, yeah. You can't sort of get the full effects without the visual side of it. This man is wheelchair bound and breathing with an oxygen tank in his nostrils. And throughout the song, you actually hear the little pulse of the oxygen tank as it goes along. And he's singing, he's fronting this choir called Young at Heart from Massachusetts, which has a sort of median age of about 83. And it's been going for decades now, and kind of led by this charismatic choir leader, they've sort of stepped away from the old-timey song repertory of a normal seniors choir and started singing rock songs and punk rock songs even, and just trying to sort of challenge the expectations of what old people can do. And, you know, that man actually has a lovely voice, but it's not a polished professional voice, and some of the singers in the choir are less polished than that. But it's really becomes just this celebration of what music means to us as human beings and the kind of deep depth of emotion that it can convey, and the technical things all kind of fall away. And I think that's one of the things that looking at this field of bad singing, so-called, reminds us, is that in some ways there's just something deep and kind of unspeakable about what music can do, and concerns about good and bad in many ways on that level can get in the way of, you know, something that we've often lost touch with, which is the pleasure of just coming together as people, as families, as communities, and making music without concern for performance and the music industry and all of those questions.
Well, Carl, it's a really fascinating subject, and thank you so much for speaking with me.
Thank you so much.
Carl Wilson is music critic for Slate. There's a link to read his article, Why Do We Love Bad Singing? And that's at our website, wordofmouthradio.org.